KLL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. It's 1 o'clock here in WILL AM 580. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. Champaign-Urbana is a college town. It's a university town. Many of our listeners are affiliated with universities or places of higher learning currently, or they have been in their life, and all many of us think about it quite a bit. Today we're going to have as a guest a scholar who's done a lot of work on the state of higher education in the United States today, and the report is not good. It's going to be an extraordinary show, I think. I think you'll enjoy it. But before we go to our guest and talk about the state of higher education and the quality of learning today in American colleges and universities, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Do you remember when TV broadcasters switched from analog to digital programming? The shift was supposed to give us a windfall of super Wi-Fi from airwaves TV broadcasters no longer need. Wi-Fi comes to us courtesy of unlicensed spectrum, the part of our airwaves not designated for licensed wireless use like radio, TV, and mobile phones. Michael Weinberg is a staff attorney for Public Knowledge.
Everything that happens on Wi-Fi right now happens on spectrum that is not very good at transmitting information. TV spectrum is really good at transmitting information, so you can get spectrum that can transmit a lot more information a lot farther.
In other words, with Wi-Fi transmitted over TV spectrum, known as white spaces, you would no longer have to worry about being two walls apart from your router when using your laptop. The plan was for the Federal Communications Commission to keep part of the white spaces for unlicensed use and auction off the rest. But political wrangling is holding this spectrum hostage. The House tacked on three amendments to its must-pass payroll tax bill, amendments that spell big trouble for the FCC and spectrum use.
This bill doesn't protect that super Wi-Fi. When they talk about the spectrum that they're going to try and auction off, they don't say, but you must reserve a certain percentage for super Wi-Fi. And without doing that, we're concerned that the FCC won't preserve the super Wi-Fi unlicensed band.
The Senate version of the bill doesn't include anything about spectrum. The House and Senate are now trying to hash out their differences.
The House version includes a lot of other random spectrum stuff that's pretty much all bad. One of the conditions says, FCC, when you auction off this spectrum, you cannot impose any net neutrality protections at all. The FCC can't do anything to make sure that the person who wins that spectrum auction doesn't abuse their position and really control what Internet users use.
Another provision calls for spectrum going only to the highest bidder, instead of creating conditions for more competition and lower prices. Weinberg is part of a group of consumer and media advocates who are trying to kill the spectrum amendments.
If this goes wrong, it's not necessarily that what is happening right now changes for the worse. It's that the good things that could happen in the future do not happen.
For more information, go to publicknowledge.org.
Whip out your smartphone at a rally in Chicago to record a heated conversation between a police officer and a protester, and you could be sent to prison for 15 years. The Illinois Eavesdropping Act prohibits recording a conversation without consent, lobbing the steepest penalties at people who make audio recordings of law enforcement. Here's Adam Schwartz, senior lawyer with the Illinois chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Illinois, in fact, has one of the most restrictive laws in the country in terms of stopping people from making audio recordings of on-duty police officers in public places.
But a new bill could change this, allowing people to record on-duty cops in public without permission. Schwartz said the new bill would simply restore rights already granted under the First Amendment. In fact, the ACLU of Illinois challenged the current law as unconstitutional and filed a lawsuit in 2010 that was dismissed. The ACLU appealed the case, which is pending. Schwartz said the new bill would also increase police accountability.
Sometimes there's a swearing contest about whether the officer used a racial epithet, or there's a swearing contest about whether or not the civilian said one thing or another that led to the officer to use force against the civilian. or there'll be a dispute about whether or not the officer refused to give their badge number or made a threatening remark. These disputes will be far more easily resolved if civilians are allowed to document their encounters with police. And we believe that the First Amendment protects the right of civilians to gather such information.
Illinois is gearing up to host this spring's NATO and G8 summits, which are likely to generate public protests and interactions with police. Many people may unknowingly violate the current law if they attempt to record police, and Schwartz says the rule has strong repercussions for journalists.
It would be a crime for anyone, whether they are a professional journalist or an independent blogger or just a member of the protest, to pull out their phone or some other device and to record this discussion between the police officers and the civilians about whether or not they're marching where they're supposed to be marching. So this is a major restraint on freedom of speech and freedom of the press here in Illinois.
In good news for proponents of the new bill, the existing eavesdropping law is facing another legal challenge. Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan has asked the state Supreme Court to address whether the law is constitutional. For more information, visit aclu-il.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, 212-12 here on WILL AM 580. I first learned about the research of our guest today a year or so ago. A column in the New York Times by the former Times columnist Bob Herbert addressed the book we'll be talking about today and the author we'll be speaking with today. And I went out and bought the book, Academically Adrift, almost immediately and read it soon thereafter, and I went through my notes in the book, my margin notes, just before the show a couple days ago, and I have all these like checks and wow and great, this is it, enthusiastic responses. And it's a book I think that will get the attention of the listeners to Media Matters like few of our other programs have. Our guest, Richard Arum, co-author with Josipa Roxa of the new book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, published by the University of Chicago Press last year. Richard Arum is a professor of sociology and education at NYU, New York University. Professor Arum, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks very much, Bob, for having me on your show.
Well, you know, let's just start in for people unfamiliar with your argument and what your research shows with just some of your findings. I think the findings are arresting. And I think for those of us who work in academia, for many of us, they're not surprising, but they're still arresting nonetheless. Let's start, Professor Arum, with, you know, what the amount of work a student does today, a college student, does today compared to, say, 50 years ago, if we can generalize.
Right. Well, we do have some evidence on that because students in college today, as well as in the past, have periodically been given surveys where they're asked how many hours a week they spend studying and preparing for class. And what those surveys show very clearly is a dramatic decrease in the amount of time the average student spends studying and preparing for class. In fact, the amounts have dropped in half in just 50 years.
And similarly, the other side of the coin, I guess, in that regard, is the demands made on students, as far as I can tell from your book, have fallen quite a bit, too, in terms of reading assignments and courses and writing requirements.
Yes, you know, absolutely. We don't have longitudinal evidence on prior reading and writing requirements, but it's certainly the case today that large numbers of students are able to navigate through higher education with very little asked of them, and therefore very little effort exerted. Some examples of that is we ask students in a typical semester how many courses they took that required them to write more than 20 pages over the course of the semester, and half of the students came back to us and said, none, we don't have any class that asked us to write more than 20 pages. We asked them how many classes they took on average where they were expected to read 40 pages or more per week. About a third of them came back to us and said, we don't have any class that has, not a single class that asks us to write more than 40 pages per week. And so,
to read more than 40, yeah.
Exactly, to read more. And then, so given that, they're not, you know, many students are not being asked to read very much, they're not being asked to write very much, and so you don't have to put in many hours studying if this is the path you've chosen through higher education, and you can do quite well.
And I think, you know, then you get really to the bottom line, so to speak, which is accordingly that a small percentage of students, or too small percentage, show much improvement in their writing or their analytical reasoning skills through the course of college.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are able to demonstrate that the students in our book, we had several thousand across 24 diverse colleges and universities in this country, and the students are given a test of their generic skills, critical thinking, complex reasoning, and writing ability. They're given this test when they come in, and then they're given it after 2 years and after 4 years. And not surprisingly, if you don't ask very much of students in terms of academic demands, and students don't put in much academic effort, large numbers of them don't move at all on this indicator after 2 years or even after 4 years.
Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Richard Arum, a professor at NYU, New York University, in both sociology and education, co-author with Josipa Roxa of the new book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, published by University of Chicago Press. The phone lines are open today at WILL. The number here, 217-333-9455, the toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Again, this book has some, I think, rather pertinent and even extraordinary findings on what's going on college campuses today. And to the author's credit, we'll be talking about it today. Professor Arum goes through a number of explanations and hypotheses for why this situation exists the way it does and other various factors that account for it. We'll be talking about those throughout the show. And I think this is a program of particular interest to those of us in this community, not to mention nationally. And I guess in a way, Professor Arum, just to broaden this out a second, anyone who's, you know, has kids who are going to go to college or is someone planning to go to college, I mean, this story now is not just one of people in the industry. This is really about our society, isn't it?
No, I think that's absolutely right, because the consequences aren't just about our individual children and how they might fare in their future in terms of economic competitiveness, although certainly you could read the book and approach the topic with that concern in mind. I think for me, what is a much more troubling implication is the challenges this reality, the challenges that appear to maintaining a democratic society. So if you have large numbers of students who you want you would assume schools were preparing to take on the responsibilities of democratic citizenship, and in fact that's not occurring, and you have large numbers of students graduating without kind of much training or experience or interest in reading and thinking about the world, you really draw into question the ability of a society to make effective democratic decision making.
In your book, go ahead, Professor.
Yeah, well, I was going to say we've got some very concrete examples to demonstrate that, because the students in this book we've continued to follow, and have just released a report last month that shows how they're faring 2 years out of college, as well as their experiences and patterns of democratic of civic engagement and the like. And so I know one finding that'll be of particular interest to you and your listeners is we asked graduates 2 years out of college, how often do you read the newspaper in print or online? Right, these are college graduates that one would hope would be the foundation of a democratic society. And 32% of them came back and said, we read the newspaper in print or online monthly or never.
One-third, basically.
One-third.
And that includes online. That's extraordinary.
It's extraordinary. And what you have is, you know, if students are not kind of keeping up with the news, with the world, or students or graduates, you know, they are, one would imagine, increasingly susceptible to political rhetoric and making decisions in the future, based on emotional appeal or superficial reasons, and not really considering the consequences of the choices in front of them, the complexity of the issues that our society confronts, and so on.
One of the points you make in the book, and you, to your credit, Professor Arium, and to your co-author's credit too, you go through every variable and examine its role in the process. You're not finding one bad person that's sort of screwing it up and everyone else has got a white hat on. But one of the points you make early on in the book, and I think it's something that I know people at Illinois have talked about a lot on the faculty and among students, is the idea that academics, the classroom learning part, has become a lower priority, and sort of especially at the big public universities, a much lower priority. The amount of money going to administration is dramatically higher than it was a generation or two ago. That there's more fancy dorms that get more attention, lifestyle stuff. All of this sort of stuff is sort of advanced relative to classroom learning. Is this something you found in your research?
Right. This is absolutely appears to be the case in higher education today, where colleges and universities now define themselves largely on this student consumer model, where the idea is to satisfy students as consumers and clients, and invest in those needs as they're expressed, and not take responsibility for traditional educational guidance and social development of youth. And so, if you ask an 18 or 19-year-old kid today, you know, what do they want out of their college? Quite a few will think about kind of rigorous academic preparation and think about investing today to develop the skills and competencies for their success tomorrow. But quite a few of them will at that age would say something entirely different and would emphasize instead the social aspects of colleges and universities, the athletic facilities, the student centers, the quality of the dorm rooms, and so on. And, you know, rather than challenge, you know, it traditionally schools accepted the responsibility of confronting youth and challenging them and providing an alternative account of what colleges and universities are about. Today, rather than accept that responsibility, we run around satisfying their short-term expressions of need.
You know, Professor Arium, back in the old Soviet Union, there was a joke among workers, which was, you know, we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us. And I sort of thought of that when I read your discussion of this sort of new consumer model of education at universities, because the point you make, and correct me if I'm wrong in this interpretation, is that, you know, students do as little work as possible and seek out classes that don't push them that hard. And faculty sort of go along with it because by doing that, it gives them more time to do what they want to do.
Yeah, and again, large numbers of students, not all students.
That's right.
Large numbers have been convinced that what college is largely about is leaving with a credential, and the credential itself, without consideration of what went into attaining it, is going to be all they need in the future. And on the other side, faculty, administration, and so on, the incentives to focus on everything but undergraduate learning are immense. Colleges and universities today are measured in these ranking systems, the U.S. News rankings for one, but the NRC has rankings, the multiple rankings. You do not find undergraduate learning and the quality of instruction and academic rigor anywhere in those metrics. Instead, you have metrics such as what are the characteristics of students as they come into college? What is the percentage of applicants that you reject? What is the percentage of students that you graduate? External research funds being brought into your university by prominent faculty and the like? Again, these are all perhaps very worthy goals, but none of them have anything to do with whether or not students are learning anything at the institutions.
Our guest today here on Media Matters is Richard Arum, the co-author with Josipa Roxa of the new book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, just published by the University of Chicago Press. The phone lines are open here at WILL at 217-333-9455 and our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the toll-free line right now, line 4. Ann Arbor, you're on the air with Professor Arum.
I have a question which you probably have partially answered with your discussion of the consumer model of education with the fancy upgrades to dorms and cafeterias or cafes or whatever they call them now. And, I certainly remember the rec building being outfitted to resemble kind of a fancy gym, or health spa or something like that. When I was in my undergrad, and when I was in law school, they added, the sort of quasi-glitzy waterfalls with, rocks and things that look nice in the atrium and the lobby. But in addition to that, I have a couple other, two or three observations here. One is that a lot of my classes, some lectures, not just discussions, were taught by a fair number of teaching assistants. And, I don't want to make it sound like I'm dogging them, but I certainly do feel that it's unfair to expect them to teach as well as a member of the faculty who's, supposed to be a teacher, not just someone trying to fund their education. And I feel that, decreases the total amount of learning and expectations overall for a lot of people. And, at the same time, I think that I saw a statistic that said that, over the past 30 years or so, or, maybe it's 40 years, I can't remember specifically, but the cost of tuition has gone up, 2.5 times the cost of, everything else. So we're spending more and more money. We're getting less and less education and lower quality education. And I know that there's a fair amount of outside funding, from businesses. My question is, where exactly is all of this money going? What's sort of the political economy or the allocation of resources? Because the reason why we're turning to more and more TAs is because they're a lot cheaper than paying faculty. So, if you can see where I'm kind of going with this, is that I just don't understand is that we had a pretty good university system, for a long time. We have more money going into it, but it seems that we have less good outcomes. So I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Excellent questions right off my list, Professor Arum.
Well, there's a lot on that he put on the table there. So first of all, let's also just be clear that the pattern of increasing resources, tuition going up at twice the rate of inflation since the 80s, and institutions investing in kind of fancy dorms and student centers and the like is indeed a reality in part of higher education. But there's other institutions out there, lower tier public colleges and universities that are starved for resources today, and so it's a complex phenomenon if you look at it. And I don't think I think we owe it to the audience to acknowledge that complexity here. Now, the second thing is the caller is absolutely right that the percentage of courses that are taught by full-time faculty have dramatically decreased over time. And it's not just the case that those courses are now being taught by teaching assistants. Large numbers of them are taught by adjuncts. And the difference there, of course, is that teaching assistants, graduate students, are being trained to be future professors, and it's not simply the case that they are a cheap source of labor. In fact, the universities often invest lots of money in their graduate programs, at the expense of undergraduate education, and so it's complex there. But certainly the case that adjunct instructors are dramatically increased, and those are absolutely the rationale. There is the is by and large the lower expense associated with it. So to end my response here would be the bigger question: where is the money going? The money is going, if you look at the expenditure flows in these colleges and universities, the money is going everywhere other than the classroom, everywhere other than investing in the academic experiences and the classroom experiences. And so if you look at administrative salaries, they are dramatically on the rise. If you look at the amount invested in student services, again, dramatic increases in colleges and universities in the amount of student services that are provided. If you look at the amount of resources spent on faculty research, you see that increasing also. So again, almost across the board, you find increases in expenditures other than around undergraduate education. And again, you see, if anything, a disinvestment in that, where cheap alternatives such as adjunct instructors are often used, and faculty are encouraged to focus on other activities other than undergraduate education.
In that other activity that faculty are encouraged to look at, especially at the what are called research universities like NYU or the University of Illinois, is research. And, you know, one of the issues that comes up in your book, and it seems like a complex issue to me, is, you know, is research the problem? Is the problem that faculty get too many rewards for research and not enough for teaching? And is that a way to solve the problem, is to limit the emphasis upon research, at least at, you know, some schools, if not all?
Yeah, so one of the interesting things is, in major research universities, research and scholarship have long been the coin of the realm in terms of tenure and promotion decisions and compensation of faculty and so on. That, there's nothing new there. What is new, however, is that model began to diffuse broadly through higher education. So now it is not just the case in research universities that faculty are told again and again that their tenure decisions, their promotions, their compensation are going to be driven not by their teaching, but by research. We see that much more broadly through higher education today. Now, however, while I say that, I don't think it's the case that it's simply research itself that is to blame, because one can imagine a research-oriented faculty having rigorous academic demands on their students, right? Demanding that students read and write, and holding them accountable for not, and having tougher grades. The trouble is there's just no incentives to do that in higher education today. And in fact, the incentives are in the opposite direction, because when we assess teaching, we assess teaching in colleges and universities typically with course evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
And so students are asked at the end of the semester, you know, basically they're asked, how much did you like the class? And guess what? You know, they like the classes more when they're entertaining and
easy.
And easy. And you know, the grades that students anticipate they're going to get correlate highly with whether or not the students are going to report that they like the class.
You know, one of the points that you make in the book, Professor Arum, that struck home with me is the pressure on departments to have the largest possible enrollment because their resources are oftentimes attached to that. And I know a professor, a very prominent scholar, who's been teaching a large undergraduate class through most of his career, pretty much the same way, and won numerous teaching awards. And in recent years, he found that the class was getting more difficult for undergrads. They were more resistant to doing what had been a standard amount of work in previous years. And finally, his department chair said to him, you know, you're just going to have to, frankly, dumb it down here, or we're not going to keep these enrollments up that we need.
Yeah, as we argue, the incentives are all pointed to less academic rigor and dumbing down the curriculum. You'll see the exact pattern that we see out there, and that is that students' investment in higher education has dramatically decreased. It's dropped at half in terms of hours studying. And you'll see the grades going up, and we do see the grade inflation across the board. And, what you basically have in higher education today is a race to the bottom. You know, and I find it kind of ironic that our politics today, in Washington, we talk about a race to the top in K-12 education, but when we shift it to higher education, we start talking about cost. We start talking about making sure students graduate quicker and more often. You know, and these are all worthy goals, but where is learning? Why isn't learning on the table? And if it's not on the table, you will get institutions taking shortcuts to reducing cost and graduating more students. The easiest shortcut to take is a race to the bottom, just making the curriculum easier and making graduation easier.
Our guest today on Media Matters, who you've just been listening to, is Richard Arum. He's the co-author with Josipa Roxa of the new book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning on College Campuses, just published by University of Chicago Press. Our phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. And we've just touched the surface of what's in this book, and we'll use the last half of the show, I hope, to get as much of the book as possible because there's so much in here. Professor Arum, I recall when I went to college, and to date myself, in 1971, and I went to a small liberal arts college, sitting around the first week or so that we gathered as classes were just about to begin with a bunch of kids, all of us about 18, and talking about what we're interested in studying. And this is 1971. It was all philosophy, history, psychology, politics, sociology, a whole range of what today we would call liberal arts courses. It's one of the things that was striking then. If someone had said, I want to study how to do advertising campaigns, we would look at them like they were insane. Like, what are you coming to a college to study something like that for? If you want to learn that, you know, go get a job at an ad agency or something. And when I read your book, the statistics are that there's been a dramatic shift in sort of the focus of undergraduate education away from what were traditional liberal arts toward more instrumental fields. And this seems to affect sort of the findings you're getting, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You see some of the largest majors on college campuses today are things like business programs. When we looked and we asked business students in our study what was required of them, they had some of the lowest requirements in terms of reading and writing and hours studying, the lowest growth on this measure of generic higher order skills. And so what I would, I think part of the problem is that colleges and universities have not taken the responsibility to provide a counter-narrative to the students that are coming in with those orientations. So the fact that students are coming in today to colleges and universities and given the economic climate, saying, we hope to prepare ourselves, so that we can get a job after college and university. That's fine that students are coming in with those orientations. But what colleges and universities, I think, are often failing to do is providing a narrative that, college and universities are one, about so much more than that. They're about being in a college is a privilege that requires one to take responsibility, not just for themselves, but for making a contribution to the larger society. And two, even if all you are interested in is your individual professional advancement, even if that's the case, you are well advised to invest in these generic higher order competencies, critical thinking, complex reasoning, the ability to write effectively and make logical arguments, because those generic skills are the ones that are transferable from job to job. And students today preparing themselves narrowly for a particular occupation, we have a responsibility to tell them that that occupation that they're preparing themselves for might not exist in 10 or 20 years. Or if it exists, it might not be found in the U.S. It might be outsourced. And so you have to prepare yourselves for more broadly, because those generic higher order skills are the ones that transfer well from job to job, occupation to occupation, industry to industry.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest, Richard Arum, co-author of the new book, Academically Adrift, Limited Learning in College Campuses. Let's go to line one now. Champagne, you're on the air.
Hi. When I was listening, I was really struck by some of the things you were saying and how basically appalled I have been at the University of Illinois' so-called branding initiative, and how much it just sort of plugs into what you've been saying about what I would call the corporatization of the university, or the making it a commodity to be consumed by students. And going along with that, I think, is the same kind of things that happens in U.S. corporations all over, where there's a tremendous push for high salaries in the administrative level and a degrading almost of everybody else within the structure, including the staff, the faculty, the grad assistants on this campus, which have kind of fought for some rights, and how basically kind of this mentality has certainly seeped into the University of Illinois. And I take it from what you've been saying, universities across the country. Personally, especially when you consider how many people, you really wonder where this comes from, when so many thousands of, so many students want to come to someplace like this. It's not like we lack good applicants, but somehow or another, the administration has decided this is a place to put their effort and energy. And I think that on our campus, at least, faculty and staff and students are trying to kind of join together and push back some of this, and really is calling the administration to task. On Tuesday, we're having a rally, Have a Heart rally, where basically we're calling on the university to get back to its true heart, which is the pursuit of academic excellence and the movement back towards an education that resembles the education many of us older people had.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And let me just add on to that, Richard Arum, if I can, to follow up on the caller's points. Who is the constituency to take hold of the university and get it back to being more focused on really doing great undergraduate education?
Well, unfortunately, we think that the situation that exists now is the product of a conspiracy of interest, where no one no one has been pushing for academic quality and excellence. And in fact, everyone is, you know, faculty are incentivized to focus on research. Students, all they care about is a credential. Administrators are focused on other issues. And so, so where does change possibly occur? So I would say a few possibilities emerge. First of all, by undergraduate education and the quality of undergraduate education being pushed out and underemphasized in colleges and universities today, it basically also pushes faculty to the periphery of higher education. If undergraduate education and the quality of instruction isn't at the core of the institution, well, why do you need a full-time faculty? One could imagine in the future, if you just look at the way the numbers are going and trending, one could imagine a college and university of the future where there are no full-time faculty, where instruction is delivered by adjuncts and on through online modules, the colleges and university is populated by administrators and large numbers of student service professionals that are attending to student needs and keeping them plugged into the to these instructional delivery systems. You know, so if that's a frightening thought to faculty members, you know, faculty could be at the forefront of reclaiming the place for undergraduate education in colleges and universities today. So that's a possibility, although, again, all the incentives for individual faculty would be to not focus on that, but to focus instead on their individual research programs. One could imagine students being upset with this deal, that students come to realize that colleges and universities that are their college and university education, which is increasingly paid for by taking out large student loans and loans that you can never walk away from in the future, regardless of your economic situation. The students that we were studying when they graduated, two-thirds of them had student loans, and they averaged $27,000 in debt, with about 12% of those with loans averaging more than $50,000 in debts when they left colleges and universities. One might imagine that these students might say, hey, the college and university is focusing on all these other things that are kind of peripheral to my short-term and long-term needs. So these things are all possible. But again, I don't think they're in any way natural or inevitable. And instead, I think actually the results we're getting in the system are exactly the ones you'd expect given the incentives to actors that exist in higher education today.
Before we get back to our next caller, I want to make sure you have a chance to talk about the issue of inequality and how it affects academic performance. It's a big part of the book, both class, economic, and race and racism. And I just want to give you a chance to sum up some of your findings there, because I don't want people to think this was not an issue that was central to your mission.
Exactly. Well, you know, as a sociologist, my research is a longstanding interest in issues of inequality, and you're right, it's central to the book, but the coverage in the media has largely kind of ignored that that question and issue and set of findings. And so what we find in the book is that it is particularly African-American students that are being poorly served by colleges and universities today, that they come in and their gains on this measure are the lowest. The gaps between performance of white students and African American students grows over time. The longer people are in higher education, the more unequal the outcomes are. We're not particularly surprised by this finding, because whereas in K-12 education today, there is a national public discourse around closing the achievement gap and making sure all students learn. There's a discourse and policy around that in K-12 education. In higher education, we find the opposite. We find that there is, with few exceptions, there is virtual silence on the question. And instead, there's often the implicit message given to faculty to not focus on students that are struggling, but instead to focus only on the most talented, the talented 10th, and focus. That's where the most rewards and personal satisfaction comes from, and figure out strategies to limit one's time with students that are struggling. And so I find it not at all surprising, given the lack of discourse and policies around this, that, again, we see growing inequality around racial differences the longer students are in higher education.
Our guest, Richard Arum, co-author with Josipa Roxa of the new book, Academically Adrift, just published by the University of Chicago Press. Phone lines open here at WILL, 333-9455, or toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to a caller who's been waiting very patiently. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes, two questions. One, a simple factual question that something you just said relates to, and the other, a more speculative one. The factual question is, a substantial proportion of the people who graduate from college go on to professional school. And so to make the transition, they have to take exams of one sort or another, the GREs, the law school exam, med school stuff. Over time, are student performances, are graduate performances on those examinations showing the effects of the poor quality undergraduate education that you've been talking about? The speculative question is this. Suppose that the SAT and the GRE, or things like them, perhaps somewhat further developed, were allowed to stand in for their respective credentials, so that if a student appeared at a college with SAT scores of a certain level, whether he had graduated from high school or not would be of no consequence. And similar for professional schools, for students who would approach with GRE or scores on the appropriate professional exams of sufficient height, that they would not need a college diploma in order to be considered. And I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much, caller. Richard Ayer?
So, I mean, I think the growth, we measure growth on this indicator, the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which, again, measures critical thinking, complex reasoning, and written ability. It's not identical to the competencies that are measured on SAT and GRE scores, but one would imagine you would see somewhat of a similar pattern today. Now, both the SAT and the GRE, they are instruments that are used to kind of rank, if you will, students relative to others. So the GRE would be used to sort out a high and low ability students, high and low ability graduates relative to each other, without really speaking to the issue of whether or not students had actually learned anything over their four years of education.
Or compare them historically, if it's an index method.
Historically, and in fact, yeah. The GREs and SATs, they're standardized over time and adjusted to kind of to not be susceptible to change over time measures, change over larger patterns that might mm-hmm. be influencing them. So Now that you shifted to a second question, could one imagine a scenario where in the future a competency test, maybe a GRE, could be used to get into graduate school without consideration of undergraduate attainment per se, a diploma? And I would say that's highly unlikely because the graduate programs are run by the same institutions that run the undergraduate programs. So there's no incentive to eliminate that requirement. Now, what's interesting, however, is employers today. And what we find, I said earlier in the show that we're following these graduates into the labor market. And what we find is the students that are lucky enough to find full-time work, and many of them are not so fortunate. But if they did, we asked them, did the employer ask to see the transcript? And the vast majority say no. The employer didn't really wasn't interested in seeing my transcript, and that's probably not surprising because it's hard to make heads or tails out of these transcripts today. What these courses mean and what the grades indicate with the wild grade inflation that exists in many colleges and universities today, it's hard to know what the meaning of these transcripts are. So what employers are starting to do is give competency tests to individuals applying for jobs. In fact, that's what I've started to do myself. I hire college graduates to help with various research endeavors that I'm involved in, and I've come to the conclusion that I cannot trust the college transcripts to tell me credible information because many graduates I've hired can't write it. You know, it turns out that they can't write a coherent paragraph or a business letter or think critically. And so I give the individuals I've been hiring in recent years, I give them a concrete performance task to do and see whether or not they can think on their feet and are able to apply the knowledge that they should have learned in colleges and university to a real world problem that they're confronted with.
When I hear you say that, Professor Arum, I wonder then if eventually there's going to be what some have forecast sort of a bubble in higher education. If at some point there's a tipping point where employers and the nation at large realizes the learning is pretty substandard or it's hard to really see at the college level, so you can't really use the degree in a meaningful sense. At some point then people are going to stop getting the degrees, aren't they?
Well, I'm not so sure because, again, the question of to get a degree or not get a degree is the question is compared to what,
mm-hmm.
And so if a college degree versus a high school diploma still signals to individuals that an individual is more motivated and that it still serves as a signal regardless of whether or not any learning at all has occurred there. It also, I should say, we often look at colleges and universities in terms of labor market outcomes, but guess what? There are other outcomes related to college enrollment that are perhaps equally important to individuals, such as marriage market outcomes. So we increasingly live in a society where people marry or partner with others from the same educational background, educational attainment levels as they have, and no longer are they marrying based on class background, racial characteristics, religion. Increasingly, they're marrying on educational achievement level. So where you go to school, how much you go to school and where you go to school continues to shape marriage market outcomes, even if, again, there's little academic rigor and little is learned there.
Professor Arum, we've only got a few minutes left, and I have one question. that I've been wanting to get to that occurred to me as I read your book. Higher education until the middle of the 20th century was a fairly small percentage of Americans had the privilege to go to a college or university for 4 years. And so teaching, and it was primarily, though not exclusively, middle class and upper class people, and teaching them critical skills and the like was necessary because they're going to be running society and they had to have the ability to think on their feet and shift jobs and deal with new situations. When you go to a situation where a significant percentage of the American society is now at college, university, doesn't it dangerous if you're teaching critical skills to people who are not going to be managers when they go out into the world and maybe are going to, especially in a stagnant economy, be unemployed? Isn't it? Do you really want those people knowing to be critical thinkers?
Well,
from the perspective of the people who run our society, not from the people at the bottom end of it.
I understand. So first of all, let me challenge the setup to the question first. So we hear a lot of rhetoric today about college for all. But that's simply not the case. The vast majority of people do not get a 4-year college degree. In fact, although they might finish high school and go to a community college, they often drop out in their first year. We don't have the rest of the world is graduating more and more. People from 4-year colleges. The U.S., much less so. And so in the 60s and 70s, there was a dramatic expansion in the percentage of individuals that went on to a 4-year college and got degrees. From 1980 on, it's been relatively flat with only very small, modest improvements. So again, the majority of people today, 2/3 of them, don't have a 4-year degree, and so I think.
So we can afford to let the people who go be critical thinkers.
I think it's it's too cynical, if you will, to posit. So to kind of post hoc look at the situation and explain the outcome that you get as being driven by the intentionality of powerful actors in society. I don't think you need that. You don't need that apparatus to do the work here. All you have to do is look at the organization and look that no one in the organization is focused on improving academic rigor in undergraduate education. You don't need some mysterious forces from up high.
No, I don't think it'd be mysterious. It'd simply say that if there was strong pressure in our society to have a lot of critical thinkers who could think analytically and have those skills, there'd be implicit pressure to generate more of them at our universities.
Well, I would say yes and no. So I would say, first of all, you hear a lot of hand-wringing from the business community about the quality of college graduates and how they're not being properly trained in critical thinking.
Professor Arum, I hate to have started you off on that great topic because I hear the band tuning up. They're kicking me out of the studio right now. Richard Arum, author of Academically Adrift with Josipa Roxa, thank you so much for taking time from your Sunday to talk to us today.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Yeah, and I'll be back next week with my guests, Bruce Williams and Michael Delli Carpini, talking about the state of journalism. I want to thank Kyle Krohoff for working the board. I want to thank Christina Williams for being my producer. And you great listeners for tuning in. See you in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The weather is sunny today. That's the last day of the week we can say that. Highs around 30 with gusting winds around 25. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low around 17 degrees. Monday, cloudy, a 50% chance of snow in the afternoon. Highs in the lower 30s, south winds 10 to 15 with gusts to around 25. This is Illinois Public Media, WIOL.